This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. 13 foreign peacekeepers have been killed in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo in fighting between the Congolese army and Rwandan-backed M23 rebels. They are advancing on the city of Goma. That's very close to the border with Rwanda, and it is significant because even though M23 did actually briefly enter Goma around a decade or so ago, they have never held as much territory as they do now. And they're succeeding in part because of revenues they're deriving from taxing mining operations in places they control. So the government seemed to be on the back foot. And Emery Macomino is the BBC reporter in Kinshasa. He joined me a short while ago, just after going to a government press conference. So what was said there?
The press conference is still ongoing as we speak. Well, what they've said so far is that they paid the tribute to Governor Peter Sirimwani, the governor of North Kivu province, who was confirmed dead yesterday. They say he was killed by a sniper. He was with troops in the battlefield about 20 kilometers west of the capital city of the province, Goma. That's briefly what has been said. The government also says that they are documenting all these killings happening in the country so that they would pursue Rwanda via international justice.
Okay, so they're very much pinning everything on Rwanda being responsible for the advance on Goma, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The Rwandan army has 3,000 to 4,000 troops, which are helping the M23 to gain territories and even trying to capture the town of Goma.
And so do we have any sense of whether the government is able to, get its army to resist this? I mean, what are they saying?
Well, within the last 2 days, the government is redeploying on the field. And today we heard also the interim governor speaking. He said if the M23 is gaining ground in the remote areas, it won't be the same battle inside the city. If they try to regain Goma, it's going to be very difficult for them because the army is prepared to defend Goma at all costs, and they are going to regret that.
So through the day, we've also had news that peacekeepers have been killed, 3 South Africans and others killed in the fighting around Goma. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I've just gotten some clarifications a few hours ago with the South African National Defense Forces. They've confirmed that they've lost 9 soldiers in the battlefield in DRC. 7 soldiers that belonged to the Southern African mission in DRC deployed at the end of 2023. And you have 2 other soldiers from South Africa with the MONUSCO, the UN contingent. There were many other that were injured, but without giving any specific number. Also, another sad news is from the Malawi Defense Forces that confirmed the death of 3 Malawi soldiers who were also engaged in defending the Congolese army.
And reporting from Kinshasa, that was Emery Macomino. Well, people are now fleeing Goma, and the UN is warning that the violence could actually spill into a wider regional war, in part because of Rwanda's support for M23 with arms and soldiers. Well, Martin Gordon is the Anglican Bishop of Goma, and I spoke to him from there earlier today. So what's the latest news he has as to what's going on?
So the M23 are fighting on 2 fronts. There's the front up in the north, which they've seemed to have managed to have moved a bit further south towards the city in the last 24 hours. And then there's the front on the west, which is what everyone is more nervous about, where they took the strategic town of Sake on Thursday and moved towards Mubambiro, which is where MONUSCO, the UN forces, had their base. But information is very patchy and often not very reliable at all.
And the Congolese army is trying to resist that. You're seeing them, presumably, in the city of Goma.
Yeah, so the Congolese army with the MONUSCO troops and the South African Defence Force, and then some local, what we call Wazalendo, so local freedom fighters is what it means. So there's a coalition on both of those fronts pushing back the M23. As each time a city or a town falls, there are casualties and there's huge displacement. If it falls multiple times over a number of days, it's even worse.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that UN troops are on the ground. There's also the question of Rwandan sponsorship of M23. So there's international involvement. Can you tell us what the status of the UN forces are? And presumably they're under the normal UN restrictions about when they can use force.
They do have an offensive mandate. They are under the control, the authority of the Congolese forces. They provide a lot of the military hardware as well. The other question of the Rwandan involvement, the high representative of the European Council this morning, in the early hours of this morning, issued a very clear and strong statement about Rwanda backing the M23, but also 3,000 to 4,000 Rwandan forces on Congolese soil. It seems to be some diplomatic pressure now being brought to bear in the last couple of days, but I think the sense of the people of Goma is they are disappointed with the response of the international community.
Have you got your family with you?
Yes. So my wife works here, and we have our two boys, 13 and 10.
Gosh.
And
okay.
A girl who's 8.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So
okay.
They and their school is towards the west of the city. So Tuesday, my eldest said that if there was a lull in the class, you could hear the bombs. He said on Wednesday, even a class of 30 boisterous kids you could hear the bombs over that. And then Thursday, everyone was sent home from school across the city, and no one's been at school since then.
So what are people expecting if M23 reach the centre of Goma?
There are some who've had experience of this at least once before, when they took the city in 2012. They were here for 9 days. Last time they entered the city, there wasn't much fighting. There seemed to be a bit of looting as they left. But that was based on an agreement, which obviously the current M23 would say that has not been respected, which is why they took up arms again. But the sense is that they might come in quietly, they might come in peacefully, but the stories we hear of the other places that they have taken, I mean, in the UN Group of Experts report, there's atrocities, there's beheadings, there's people being burned alive, there's systematic rape as a weapon of war. So there's a real desire, the main desire of everyone in the Eastern Congo is for peace. And they will do almost anything to have peace. And I think the sense is that this has gone on way, way too long. And something needs to shift.
And that was Martin Gordon. He's the Anglican Bishop of Goma. And I should say he has actually, since recording that a few hours ago, left the city now with his family. Well, this is a conflict that is so complex, it may help to have a little explanation, and no one better to do that than Thomas Fessy, formerly with the BBC and Human Rights Watch. So, first of all, what is M23 fighting for?
The M23 is no new armed group in Eastern Congo. It's a rebel group that emerged in 2012, made up of soldiers who took part in a mutiny from the Congolese army. And mind you, these soldiers had been members of a previous rebel group, which already, you know, was backed by Rwanda some years before and had been integrated into the army in 2009 following a peace agreement. And so in 2012, they took up arms again, saying that the peace agreement had not been implemented, and the M23 being mostly made up of ethnic Tutsi Congolese, they were disputing facts of discrimination, long history of discrimination against the Tutsi community in Congo. And that's why they took arms in North Kivu in 2012. And at the time, they were supported by both neighbors, you know, Rwanda and Uganda.
So basically, ethnic Tutsis, and they're fighting because of discrimination. They're fighting based on their ethnicity, and hence the support from Rwanda too. Now, how is it that they were in Goma about a decade ago, I think it was in 2012, and yet had to pull back from that, and now they're approaching Goma again?
They were kicked out of Goma and they fled to camps in Rwanda and Uganda. They were sort of dormant for about 10 years until a few years back when they suddenly resurfaced. What happened is that Rwanda felt its zone of influence was being threatened and it felt sidelined when Congo signed a deal with Uganda for joint operations against another armed group further north in North Kivu. But crucially, the deal included also the building of roads to carry goods between the two countries, but mostly out of eastern Congo. And so there were competing interests there, which had Kigali feel that it was being cut out. And Paul Kagame, the Rwandan president, wants to remain the main player in the region, the Great Lakes region. And the M23 is somehow his card that he can play to remind everyone that he can destabilize and make people's lives incredibly difficult if he's not included in deals or in control.
I guess his role in this and the fact there are so many groups, as you describe, all reflects the fact there's a very weak central government in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And when that happens, people fill the space.
That's correct. The infrastructure, the state in Congo is weak and in some parts completely non-existent. And in fact, you know, the Rwandan president has also long argued that Congo continued to support an armed group whose leaders have links to the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. That armed group is called the FDLR. And so Kigali says that it's also supposed to take care of its national security and that the FDLR remains a threat to the country. But, you know, that argument doesn't really stand up. And it's quite clear that, you know, despite all denials, Rwanda remains behind the M23. And the fact that the M23 is able to once again knock at the door of Goma shows, you know, how much support they get from the neighboring country.
Tell us about how much international interest there is in this. I mean, it's been going on for so long. I mean, there are peacekeepers there, but it doesn't seem there's any international interest, really.
The international interest has been fading over the years. I mean, when you look at Eastern Congo, at the moment you see all the diplomatic missions and all the Western capitals, you know, not denying anymore the Rwandan support for the M23. But they stopped short of putting more pressure on Kagame and Kigali, because Kigali has been able to establish itself as a great provider of security in other countries. For example, it contributes to peacekeeping in Mozambique, for example, where, you know, the French have massive oil interests. And so some of those countries hesitate before putting too much pressure on Kigali because of other interests that Rwanda can provide with them.
And about that was Thomas Fessy explaining what's going on in DRC. Coming up a little later on NewsHour, the Australian Open Tennis Tournament is using animated players, cartoons, to broadcast free-to-watch real-time matches. So how do they do it?
There's 12 cameras around each court at the Australian Open. They're actually tracking 27 points on the player's skeleton and 5 points on the racket. And then we wrap an avatar over the top and allow the game to be replayed, if you like, but we're essentially describing or mimicking the exact same movements that the players are carrying out on court.
Stay tuned. In about half an hour, all will become clear. Headlines: 4 Israeli hostages and 200 Palestinian prisoners have been released in the second exchange of the Gaza ceasefire deal. And 13 foreign peacekeeping troops, most South African, have been killed fighting rebels in the eastern Congo. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, he's been in power for more than 30 years, and this weekend, the leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, is set to extend that in a presidential election his critics have dismissed as a sham, since his fiercest opponents and potential rivals are either in prison or in exile. In 2020, Mr. Lukashenko's claim to have won the last presidential election with 80% of the vote sparked mass protests. They were crushed by a brutal police crackdown. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, has this report from Minsk.
In a Minsk arena, at a pro-government patriotic festival, They sing, "We'll survive if we're together." The idea is to portray Belarus as a peaceful, friendly, united country. One big family. Enter the man who thinks he's the father.
President Республики Беларусь Александр Григорьевич Лукашенко.
Все вы как один мои дети.
Alexander Lukashenko tells the audience, "All of you are my children." And then he calls for a dictatorship of order, justice, and respect. This from the man who's been accused of rigging elections to keep himself in power for three decades, who holds more than 1,200 political prisoners, and who has jailed or exiled his fiercest opponents and potential rivals. A happy family, Belarus is not. The last time Belarus held a presidential election in 2020, it ended on the streets with hundreds of thousands of people accusing Mr. Lukashenko of stealing their votes. A brutal police crackdown and a wave of repression extinguished the protests, eventually, and Mr. Lukashenko held on to power. Now it's election time again, and although his critics call it a sham, the leader of Belarus will be hoping to use the vote to boost his legitimacy. After all, there are multiple candidates. I went to meet one of them.
Альтернативы Александру Григорьевичу Лукашенко как будущему лидеру страны нет.
The Communist Party leader Sergei Sirankov is running against Mr. Lukashenko, but oddly, his campaign slogan is not in place of, but together with Lukashenko. He tells me there is no alternative today to Alexander Lukashenko, a man of the people, a man of the soil, who has done everything to make sure that we don't have the kind of chaos they have in Ukraine. With opponents like this, you really can't lose. I drive 4 hours northeast of Minsk and discover that this fear of chaos and instability, it's real. It is fueled partly, but not solely, by the war in Ukraine. And it helps explain the reluctance of some people here to want a new leader. In the little town of Oktyabrskaya, Zinaida tells me, the situation today is very tense. Maybe there are other people worthy of power, but it'll take a long time for a young leader to get his feet under the desk. God forbid we should end up like Ukraine. Sergei, a local welder, tells me, I want a stable salary and a stable country. Other candidates make promises but might not keep them. I want to keep what I've got. There are many different fears today in Belarus. There is fear of the unknown, of instability, of war. And there is fear of the government, fear of speaking out. As Alexander Lukashenko seeks to extend his power, all these fears work in his favour.
Steve Rosenberg reporting. It was a heist worthy of a movie. It's 3:45 a.m. in Assen in the Netherlands. An explosion blows up an entrance into a museum with a hoard of gold, and the thieves are in and out within 3 minutes. Among the stolen items, the golden helmet of Costo Feneschti, crafted from gold dating back to 500 BC, found in a field by a Romanian child in 1928. And we can hear now from a man who could also be from the movies, art theft investigator Arthur Brand, sometimes dubbed the Indiana Jones of the art world. What does he think?
This morning when I was alerted, I hoped it would be a painting, you know, because paintings, they will try to sell. And then there is maybe a way for the police or myself to get it back. But these thieves went straight for the most beautiful piece, a golden helmet and three golden bracelets. Well, that's the worst case scenario because you can melt down gold or silver. We think that their goal is to melt these treasures down.
Right. And what kind of value would they get from that?
This helmet is priceless. It's world heritage. But if you talk only about the gold, it's not clear how much kilos it is. Maybe it's 1 kilo, 2 kilos. So they will get some tens of thousands of euros out of this. But the stupid thing is, if they get caught, they will not only be prosecuted for theft, but also for destroying cultural heritage.
Will they get caught? I mean, they left a car behind, apparently, and, you know, the whole business of getting access to explosives in Europe is not so easy. So there are some lines of inquiry?
Yes, they left a car, they burned it down. So with that in mind and the explosive use, we think they are professionals. Not so much professional art thieves, but people, criminals who this time targeted a museum, the next time they targeted a bank or whatever. So it's heavy stuff. And in the Netherlands, we have a problem. In the last year, we had 1,200 attacks with explosives. And, you know, that's a big problem.
Now, have you actually been called in to investigate this case?
Not yet. I work very closely with the police. Normally, they might call me on Monday just to hear my opinion. What they are trying to do now is on television and in the newspapers, trying to get as much information, because there's always someone who knows something. And these treasures, you know, it's world heritage. They should not be destroyed. So, and the Dutch police is a very, very professional. And I know from experience that they will not let this go. These criminals, there's no escape for them.
You haven't mentioned CCTV. Would that be an avenue of inquiry?
Yes, these thieves must have been in a museum before. You know, you cannot go in there with a bomb and entering and thinking, where should we go? So there are now police officers watching these clips from the last weeks to see if there is somebody who is not a regular museum visitor. And they say they have footage, and it will probably be tomorrow or Monday. So let's hope they will we catch before they can melt the stuff down.
Have you ever met some of these criminals that you chased down and said, look, what are you doing? You're destroying some of the most beautiful objects that exist.
These people don't think that way. I've met some of them as international thieves or Dutch criminals. There are some famous cases, but these people don't think like us. They don't see a world heritage. They see a gold bar, they can melt it down. They see a gold bar and they can buy a Mercedes or another car. They don't care. It's not in their mindset to think like this is cultural heritage. This belongs to every one of us. That's not how they think.
Art investigator Arthur Brand there, speaking to us from the Netherlands. And welcome back to NewsHour. Now, the fighting in Sudan between the forces of Army Chief General Abdel Fattah Burhan and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo is basically a struggle between two men who want power. And as they try to fulfil their personal ambitions, the situation in their country gets ever worse. The country's largest oil refinery was on fire today. Well, the British Foreign Secretary David Lammy has been visiting the Chad-Sudan border, seeing refugees there. And our senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy joined him on the visit. This is her report.
I'm standing right at the border between Chad and Sudan in Adre. There is a bridge and the pillars under it, I'm told, mark the boundary between the two countries. There are dozens of refugees arriving now from Sudan. And in the opposite direction, the lorries carrying humanitarian aid are now entering Sudan. This is what the British Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, wanted to see for himself and meet refugees fleeing the bitter civil war in Sudan.
Overwhelmingly, what I've seen here in Chad on the border with Sudan are women and children fleeing for their lives, telling stories of widespread slaughter, sexual violence against them, their children. I just sat with a woman who showed me the burn marks. She had been burnt by soldiers up and down her arms. She had been beaten and she had been raped. We must bring the world's attention to it and bring the suffering to an end.
Did you have any message of hope? Is there hope for them?
I made a promise to the women that I just spoke to that I would do all I can within my power to try and bring this crisis to an end. That means stopping the violence against civilians. It, of course, must mean a ceasefire. There has to be a political process, and we have to get aid into Sudan because there are many millions of people who haven't made their way here to Chad, and of course, many of them are worried about what they've left behind.
Nearly a quarter of a million refugees now live in Adre. They are entirely dependent on aid. Dozens have come to the food distribution center run by the World Food Programme.
A man is pulling two gunny bags of split yellow peas. It's busy here at the food distribution center in Adre. It has been hours of waiting for food rations, and the children are tired, hungry, and frustrated. But for their mothers, the patience will pay off at the end of the day. They are going to get their rations for the month. But these are among the lucky few Sudanese. Just across the border in Darfur, famine has been declared and it is spreading. And there are fears that in the coming months, unless aid is increased, famine will spread to more places in Sudan.
And that's the BBC's Anne Soy reporting from the Chad-Sudan border. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, four Israeli soldiers have been freed in the second hostage release of the Gaza ceasefire deal. In exchange, 200 Palestinian prisoners held in Israel were released. The Israeli soldiers were all young women. The release was used by Hamas to show it is still standing. Dozens of armed Hamas fighters in full combat gear surrounded the women as they were handed over to the Red Cross. Now, these soldiers were seized back in 2023, October, from an Israeli border base when Hamas attacked Israel. And in a statement, Israeli Army spokesman Daniel Hagari confirmed the releases had happened.
Since the October 7th massacre, our mission has been clear. Bring home all the hostages held by Hamas in Gaza. Today, as part of these ongoing efforts, we welcomed home four more Israeli hostages after 477 days in Hamas captivity. Liri Elbag, age 19, Naama Levi, age 20, Karina Arayev, age 20, Daniela Gilboa, age 20.
Well, the youngest of those, the 19-year-old Liri Elbag, was reunited with her parents and, as we can now hear, also had a message for fellow Israelis.
I love you all the citizens of the State of Israel who supported our families and embraced them, and all the IDF soldiers who did everything for us. Thank you very much. I love you all.
Now, in return, Israel released 200 Palestinian prisoners from jail, and there was jubilation as the buses carrying some of them arrived in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Well, the BBC's Nick Beek is in Tel Aviv. I spoke to him a short while ago and just started with some of the more recent developments centering on a hostage who hasn't actually been released yet.
This is a 29-year-old civilian called Arbel Yehud. Now, it was widely reported in Israel over the past week or so that she would be freed today, but she was not, and she hadn't appeared on this list of four hostages that Hamas sent out last night. Now, there was confusion here because, as a civilian, it was assumed that she would get priority over the four female soldiers who were released today. And what's happened is that Israel has accused Hamas of not keeping their side of the bargain. And as a consequence, Israel has said today that hundreds of thousands of Gazans who wanted to travel northwards back to their homes have not been able to do that. So this has been a complication. And what in response we've seen from Hamas is that they say actually this civilian will be released next weekend, and also, and I think in an attempt to try and get things back on track, they've given proof of life, they say, to the mediators of this very fragile ceasefire. So a lot of people are hoping that this is a stumbling block today, not least all those Gazans who want to go home.
Yeah, so the process, I mean, that notwithstanding, the process basically continues.
It does, absolutely. I think the next critical moment will be when Hamas finally releases a document, which they say they will do, and on it will be 26 names, if not names, the condition of 26 individuals, basically saying whether they're dead or whether they're alive. And it's unclear whether Hamas will connect the status to those individual people, so whether families will have any sort of certainty. But I think that is the next hurdle to get over for now.
You're, I think, in Hostage Square, as it's called, in Tel Aviv, with the families of the people who've been held hostage. What are they saying this evening as you talk to them and they contemplate the news they've had today?
A lot of people are extremely happy and pleased for the relatives of the four women who were released. There was also, though, applause for the faces of the 90 hostages remaining in Gaza. And I think the central message tonight from here, Owen, was that these people cannot be forgotten, that this fight continues until the last person is brought back. Of course, it's thought about a third of those 90 people are dead. So a range of emotions today. I think worth pointing out that the only point at which there were boos was when one of the speakers on stage mentioned the name of the finance minister, Mr. Smotrich, because he said that the war against Hamas must continue. And one of the dads of the hostages said that basically Israelis should not let the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be blackmailed by members of his coalition, those from the far right, into resuming military operations in Gaza, because everyone who's been here tonight thinks that that would massively decrease the chances of them seeing more reunions like the ones witnessed today.
Nick Beek in Tel Aviv. Let's hear about the Palestinians released today. John Donison is in Ramallah on the West Bank. So what has he learnt today about who's been released and what crimes they committed?
Well, there were a range of crimes. So out of the 200, 121 were serving life sentences, some of them for carrying out attacks which killed Israeli civilians, some of them convicted of murder, attempted murder, multiple murder in some cases. Now, those offenders, many of them didn't come here. They have been deported. They're now in Egypt and they're going to be sent on to neighboring countries such as Turkey and Qatar. Some detainees were sent to Gaza. And as you say, we had about 100, 110, something like that, coming here to Ramallah. And there were lesser offences as well. There were some people released today who were being held under what's called administrative detention. So they had never even been charged, yet had been in prison for considerable time. And the youngest, I think, today was a 16-year-old boy. And the longest serving prisoner was a man now in his 60s who was jailed in 1986 and had done some 39 years in prison.
And there was a huge welcome for all of them.
Yeah, absolutely chaotic scenes here in Ramallah. And I saw similar scenes in Gaza a short while ago when the prisoners got back there. Here in Ramallah, you know, the three prison buses, they were just swarmed with their supporters, family members, and we saw the prisoners filing off the bus. They were all in grey prison tracksuits, many of them with shaven heads, some of them with very long beards. And I have to say, they all looked pretty gaunt. They looked like they'd lost a lot of weight in Israeli detention. They were then carried on the shoulders of their supporters, and there was a mood of celebration. There was fireworks, there was chanting, and for Palestinians, you know, they see this as a rare moment of joy, I suppose.
And what about the politics of it? Hamas trying to get the credit for this?
I think they are trying to get the credit, and I think their rival faction, Fatah, which dominates the Palestinian Authority here in the West Bank, is also trying to get in on the act. So the truth, though, is I think it is a boost for Hamas, because they are able to say, look, we're getting our Palestinian prisoners out. And the prisoners, it's a massive issue for Palestinians. You know, virtually every Palestinian family will have a relative who at some point has been in an Israeli jail. And those images we saw today, Hamas will undoubtedly try and capitalise on that.
And that was John Donison. Well, after October the 7th, Israel said its objective was to destroy Hamas, and yet today's images of their fighters suggest that hasn't been achieved. Well, Hugh Lovett is a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Hamas put on a PR exercise today, but does it have any military capacity still?
The footage that Hamas has displayed in terms of the release of its hostages gives us a little bit of a glimpse in terms of Hamas's continued military capacity, but only a small glimpse because this is very much a propaganda exercise. Through research, through interviews that we at ECFR have been conducting, we know that it is still very much in control of Gaza. Despite thousands of losses, Hamas has nonetheless been able to recruit new members, and it has also mobilized some of its reserve forces. And so, to quote actually Secretary Blinken, Hamas appears to have finished the war in Gaza with about as many fighters as the start of the war.
Yeah, that is a totally amazing suggestion, isn't it? Reuters are running a story that people in Washington, intelligence official, congressional staffers and so on, are saying they've recruited between 10 and 15,000 since October the 7th.
Yeah, but we also need to add an important caveat that some of these may also be recruits to other components of Hamas. So Hamas is not just a movement of armed resistance, as Palestinians portray it, but it is also a party of governance, also has a civil administration and a civil police force. And of course, it's also a political party. So it is also possible that while it is recruiting the Qassam brigades, it is also trying to regenerate the ranks of Gaza's civil police and also trying to recruit new civil servants to run Gaza's governance.
Many outside of Gaza say Hamas should be unpopular. It brought this great suffering upon the people who live in Gaza. But how popular is it?
There is, I think, a lot of frustration and anger against Hamas's actions on the 7th of October, and especially from the point of view of Gazans, Hamas's failure to prepare for what would have been the inevitable Israeli response. And there is also criticism within Hamas against the decision of Yahya Sinwar, Hamas's then leader in Gaza, to initiate this war. However, there is far stronger anger and hatred directed at Israel. At the moment, when we look at public opinion polling, Hamas's standing in Gaza is at about 35%. And in some ways, that's actually quite constant throughout Hamas's history. The West Bank, according to one of the most recent polling, is about 37%. But it needs to be compared to the weakness of the other political parties, especially the party of President Mahmoud Abbas, the Fatah party. This is not just a question of Hamas's growing strength, but the growing unpopularity of the other political parties.
But in military terms, are the weapons still coming in? Is money still coming in?
Hamas has quite a well-developed financial infrastructure where it is able to get money through a number of businesses, fronts and investments across the Middle East and also Southeast Asia. In addition to that, it gets money from Iran. And of course, as the party of de facto governance in Gaza, it also derives revenues from taxation and border customs, et cetera, et cetera. Certainly, a lot of its weapons have been smuggled under the Egyptian-Gaza border. But Hamas also has a domestic arms production capability, which I think to a certain extent remains intact. And what it will also be doing now is recycling unexploded Israeli munitions.
I mean, Hamas has been talking, must have been talking, in the context of this ceasefire, hostage releases, prisoner swaps, all that. So can that be broadened out into a broader dialogue?
I think there's a lot of room to advance a credible political process. To me, the next step, now that there's a ceasefire, is to be able to advance towards a Palestinian reconciliation, meaning to be able to reach an agreement between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority of Mahmoud Abbas, which would allow the PA to come back to Gaza with Hamas's okay, because ultimately Hamas continues to have a veto over any post-conflict governance arrangement. Then comes the much more difficult question about how do you actually restore a credible Israeli-Palestinian political process that can actually end the occupation and fulfill Palestinian self-determination. Can President Trump and will President Trump actually put pressure on both sides, but also on the Israeli government to make the necessary compromises to be able to unlock this political process?
And that assessment from Hugh Lovett from the European Council on Foreign Relations. President Trump's decision to suspend the resettlement of all refugees to the US for an indefinite period means more than 1,600 Afghans eligible for asylum are now blocked entry to the US. Many of them worked with US troops in Afghanistan. Sean Lay talked to one of them, an Afghan man who's been in hiding with his family since the return of the Taliban 4 years ago, and we're not using his name so as not to compromise his safety.
We expected to move from Afghanistan in a month or two, but unfortunately, Mr. Trump's decision made everything go wrong. It shocked us because we have already been waiting for 4 years to get out of Afghanistan because of the danger we faced here.
Your background, I understand, is in the Afghan military. How closely were you working with the Americans and the other international forces when they were operating in Afghanistan?
Between 2017 or 18 and 2021, I was member of Airstrikes Targeting Board, a key member. I had approved and signed more than thousands of airstrike packages against Taliban and ISIS when I worked as a legal advisor and as a member of that board. I worked alongside US pilots, British and Australian pilots. We worked together.
And when the Taliban returned to power after the Americans and the other countries pulled out in 2021, 4 years ago now, what happened to you and your family? What did you do?
They took our home and they gave it to one of their commanders, and then they arrested and tortured my younger brother. My two other brothers were also officers. They were commanders, so they tortured him because they wanted to know about my location.
So for 4 years, you and your wife and your child have been effectively in hiding.
Yes, we live in hiding. My 12-year-old son is skipping his school for 3 years. Everything went wrong for us, and I was not able to get a job, go out. Everything in the past 4 years, we didn't have access to healthcare service or to proper food or something like that. We are witnessing the former military officer being killed.
What would you say to maybe the president or other Americans who support his actions against migrants, including refugees, to help them understand why you feel that this decision is the wrong decision?
They know our situation. They know what type of condition and situation we are living now in Afghanistan and what that means to be a threat to the Taliban or be a target of the Taliban. They know. So I asked them not to turn their back to us. We stood side by side with them. We sacrificed and risked our life, our family at that time to complete and fight the war we have started together against the Taliban. So I asked them to reconsider his decision and start the refugee program process because we already waiting for 4 years. We are not statistic. We are people. We fear from something. We hope for something. We dreamed of something. I asked Mr. Trump to stand on the right side of the history.
And that was Sean Lay speaking to an Afghan man who's been left in limbo by President Trump's decision to suspend the resettlement of refugees to the United States. The Australian Open tennis tournament is using animated players to broadcast free-to-watch real-time matches. So it's like a tennis match, but with cartoon players. The tennis balls are unusually large and the players' heads too. But the shots and the scores are all exactly the same as what is happening in the live event. And it's not the first time this has been done, but it is part of a growing trend. And the man behind this version of TV tennis is Tennis Australia Innovation Director, Dr. Marco Reed. So who is he hoping will watch this?
We're in the business of creating experiences for our broadcasters to be able to put to air to engage fans around the world, and that could be in a different way as it relates to an existing fan, or an entirely new way as it relates to a fan that's perhaps not watching the sport right now. So I think what we're seeing with the animated feed, it's really resonating with audiences that enjoy watching the unreal world and the fact that this is actually the real movements of players represented in that environment, I think has really engaged the global audience.
I see. So basically we've got some TV channel will have the TV rights. They'll show the TV pictures of it, the live feed. You'll see the players and all the rest of it. And then you're hoping to get basically a different audience with these cartoons. Tell us, I mean, is cartoons the right word, by the way?
Yeah, so what we're doing is we're using the electronic line calling data. So there's 12 cameras around each court at the Australian Open. They're tracking the players and the balls in real time. They're actually tracking 27 points on the player's skeleton and 5 points on the racket. And then we wrap an avatar over the top of that and allow the game to be replayed, if you like. But we're essentially describing or mimicking the exact same movements that the players are carrying out on court.
Yeah. No, so it's if it's not live, it's sort of just a few seconds after live.
That's right. It's as close as it can be. We're ingesting the data in less than 250 milliseconds and trying to push it out as quickly as we possibly can.
Gosh. And so the movements are pretty good, but not perfect. And the similarity of the players to the cartoons is, again, pretty good, but not perfect, right?
Yeah. Well, it's intentional. We've made a deliberate attempt to represent them in a gamified way. We've got an infinite number of variations in terms of the actual avatars themselves. And it's been a real evolution for us as we've entered the gaming space with our original tennis mobile game, Tennis Smash. And now we've got the animated feed in its third year.
I think in the first answer to this, you used a phrase which, was surprising. It's something like people who don't want to watch the world as it really is or something like that. So can you, what exactly did you say? And can you explain to me why people would not want to see the real world?
Maybe that's not for me or you, Owen, but yes, in essence, we're converting the real into the unreal. And as we know, there's many individuals out there in the world, many fans of sport that have grown up in an animated reality, if you like. They've grown up enjoying gaming as a vertical, and they enjoy being part of a community. So by watching on the YouTube channel, they're able to see the animated reality as well as engage in a chat forum where they're part of that community following the sport.
Well, you're obviously a genius, but I have to say, is this a good thing?
I think absolutely. Anytime that we can present an opportunity to engage fans in a deeper, more personalised way for them, it can only be a positive.
Dr. Marker Reed there, and that's it for this edition of the programme. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt
for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.